Great. Good afternoon. Why don't we go ahead and get started? So the bottom line is we're talking about some emerging findings, both from not only from the NORC study that I'm involved with and others here, but from my work and the work of others. Some of it might be intuitive to you, but I think you'll find some of it surprising, and you may disagree with some of it and be happy to hear your thoughts. And some action points for key stakeholders. So just a bit of background to make sure we're all on the same page. I don't think I need to repeat it here, but disparities exist. Whether you call them or refer to or work with health disparities or health care disparities is a distinction that I don't find useful anymore, because both they don't exist in isolation and both affect the other, and the causes are interrelated as well. And you might not want to agree, but there has been no systematic sustained improvement in any disparities in this country. We now have almost 10 years worth of the National Healthcare Quality Report and National Healthcare Disparities Report. What's happening to healthcare quality over those 10 years or almost 10 years? Is it getting better? Well, it's getting better a little bit, not very much. What's happening to disparities? No systematic improvement. We have the evidence, and there are no studies showing that. And this is not any different from anywhere else in the world, so this is a real problem. And given the demographics, the numbers, the racial, ethnic, as well as age, as well as disability and other things, these problems are likely to grow in the future, so we got to figure out this problem. Current interventional models, basically they don't work. If you take the medical model alone as a way of fixing disparities, doesn't work. Quality improvement model alone as a way of fixing, whether you're talking about public health programs or medical programs, doesn't work. Social determinants model alone, there's no evidence that that will work, and there is evidence in Europe that that won't work because they tried it. And an equity model, the same thing. The digital divide, and I'm going fast through all of these things. I could take a whole day on each one of them, but just to sort of get to the key points. Digital divide topic always comes up when we talk about this thing. It is real, but it's not what you think and not what it used to be. In fact, it's not true that most minorities and underserved populations cannot get online. In fact, they can get online and do get online fairly regularly. They're not getting online the way you think they're getting online, though. And the studies, many of the studies out there are flawed that try to assess this, because one of the major ways they look for online activity is they count, they survey how many households in America have broadband connections into their house. And it is true that there's a huge disparity in broadband connections to the house. And they also survey things like how many you have a home desktop computer. Reality is that most minorities, and I'll show you a little bit of data to prove what I'm saying. Everything that I say today is evidence-based. I'm not making any of it up. Minorities, to a much greater degree than non-minorities, do not use desktop computers to get online. Primarily, they use their mobile devices, they use their cell phones, they use their Xbox Kinects and Sony PlayStations and Wiis that you think are only for games, but they are simply internet portals and devices. And we need to begin thinking about these things as such, because the makers of those things are already and have been for a long time thinking them not only as gaming devices, but as lifestyle devices. And that's exactly how we need to think about them within healthcare and public health. And they get on quite regularly. There's even profiles of use that we could talk about, but we won't. So some emerging findings for, let's start first with the underserved populations themselves, again, so that we're on the same page. For the first time, it's been documented last year, not this year, that more people, and this includes underserved populations, more people are using electronic and online sources to get health information than talking to healthcare professionals. So if you think this is something that's not popular, you're wrong. If you think it's something that people are not doing, you're wrong. More people are going online and using electronic resources to get not only health information, but support and help and decision support and behavioral support than they are going to public health and physician and other providers in person. Now, they would love to go to their providers more, but they don't have access, and they don't have access when they need it. in the middle of the night sometimes, or they don't have to take off on their jobs to do it. So if we tend to ignore the possibilities of these things, we're only shooting ourselves and our ability to help people in the foot. As I alluded to earlier, minorities are using social media and mobile devices more than whites. And so as we think about how we're going to reach these hard-to-reach populations, if you try to do it through a desktop computer, you will fail. But perhaps by engaging social media and mobile devices more, that might erase the problem of hard-to-reach. I've never had a problem reaching the so-called hard to reach when you reach them in ways that are useful to them. Minorities use mobile devices to get online more than whites. And people are demanding real-time, on-demand access to information and interventions. The notion of providing public health services and medical services simply on an 8 to 5 when the office is open is the history. If we continue to still do that, we will fail at our interventions. They have to be available to anybody, anytime, anywhere. And that's the future, and that's why technology is changing every facet of our society. We learned a few years ago it even changed how we elect our presidents, like it or not. And this it's the same is going to be true in public health and medicine. The only question is if we, the practitioners, the leaders, are going to embrace this and lead the change, or are we going to be playing catch-up for the rest of our lives? And the biggest part of the change is not going to be with the public health system or the medical system. It's going to be those tools in the hands of patients and consumers. Consumer health informatics tools, and we may be able to say a little bit more about this. Consumer health informatics tools, those are tools that are made for patients, for consumers, that do not necessarily involve their providers or their public health professionals. They may, but they're not required to. Those have far, far more potential to help or hurt the process than anything. And I say it that way because if we don't do this right, we could end up widening disparities rather than improving them. And the reason that this is such a powerful point is if you look just at the medical care system, the core of the medical care system, not the entirety, but the core is physicians, doctors, and nurses. We have about 700,000 doctors in this country. And we have about 2.6 million nurses, and we have about 5,200 hospitals, health clinics, FQHCs, and those kinds of things. So it's roughly about 3 million entities where people have to get the core of their health care. And if all of those were electronic and information exchange was happening and all of everything, that'd be fine and fantastic. But we're moving into a phase in health and health care where now those 3 million people and entities are responsible for, as of the last census, the health of 308 million people. It's just not going to happen if you just fix the health care system. And I can say the same thing for public health. It's really doesn't make it. So I think you see the point. Social media and disparity. So here's some data. You can see here that the English-speaking Hispanic population, and this was data from 2009, so it's not that old, but I'm sure it's changed in the time, are using social media at twice the rate of whites, 36% compared to 18%, and you can see other minorities there. Another way of looking at it, if you look at two popular social media, MySpace and Facebook, you basically see the same trends. And you can say, oh, that's terrible, stay away from it, or you can say, this is where people are, let's see how we can use it to achieve the goals that we've been trying to do and erase some of the problems, although there may be others. So shift right quick to researchers, and this could be public health research, social disparities research, or social determinants. As I mentioned, sort of single-leveled insights are not working, medical, public health, whatever. We need integrated solutions that, you know, we don't live in test tubes and we don't live in isolated, as a isolated social determinant. We all interact with many different things and they all contribute to the outcomes. And so we have to understand the problem in that way. The thing is, they're all systems and it's exceedingly complicated, which makes the point that we're not going to be able to figure this out without enhanced computing power and technologies and algorithms and things like that. And so on one side, technology in the future has the potential to help us understand better how disparities happen. Because right now, our understanding is limited and our success nil, because I think largely we're taking one-dimensional approaches. Oh, it's the social determinants. Oh, it's the medical. Oh, it's the public. It's all of those things. And it's all of those things together, and it's all of those things over the lifetime, and it's all of those things changing. Try figuring that out without advanced computing power. And this is the basis of what, the work we're doing in populomics. Others are talking about syndemics. And others are referring to all of this as big science, because in actuality, I think that you can see that these are, to try to figure all this out and put all these things together, you're talking about exceedingly large studies, you're talking about very diverse data sets that include, environmental air pollution data with behavioral data, with clinical data, with genetic data, all at the same time, and trying to figure, and community and neighborhood level data, all of the race, discrimination, all at the same time. And we're talking about really going beyond multi-level modeling and traditional surveillance. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about something entirely different that would not be possible without the innovations in computing technology, leading to some of the things that we're working on, populovigilance. We may be able in the future to look at a population of people because of what we've learned about how things are caused and say, hey, if we see these things happening, we might be able to do something to actually prevent a disparity from happening in a population before it even happens, by picking up those sentinel events that lead, or those things that lead to the disparities even happening. And on the other side of the coin, we may be also to focus on disparities, harm reduction. We may not be able to stop disparities from happening in a given population or problem, but if we can reduce the amount of harm to that population, even in the context of that disparity, is that a bad thing? You might say it is, but I think at least as an interim step, it's better than nothing. It's better than absolutely no success, which is what we have right now. And on the other side of the coin, technology can also be an interventional agent. That's what we've heard a bit about, but a lot more work needs to be done on explicating the sociobehavioral, the factors that need to be in from literacy and other things that need to be incorporated in the design of tools. We're working some in that area. We have a paper under review for what we're calling culturally informed design principles and new analytic methods. In fact, all of this stuff is not entirely new. And the other sort of principle I would say is to, and I think I have this coming up somewhere, we need to avoid reinventing the wheel. We think that because we looked in our literature and don't see anything, it hasn't been done. In fact, some of these things done, at least in some levels, have been done in other fields. Human factors engineering, it's now called ergonomics. They've actually done work many, 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 many years ago looking at cultural factors and how they're important in the design of technology. Why in the world? Back in the 70s, I found papers in their literature, not in the medical literature, not in the public health literature, but in the engineering literature. Why in the world would they be so interested in this so many years ago? Anybody know? What's that? Nuclear, absolutely right. The nuclear agency is one, the aviation agency is another. We have global systems now to run our airplanes, and we have global systems to run our nuclear plants. So if we have people running airplanes in China that don't think the same way and don't act as so because of their culture, it's a globalization phenomenon, that could cause problems, and in fact it did cause many, many problems. And so people were thinking about how do we design our systems better so that the cultural differences that exist from anthropometrics to cognitive differences by culture and other things, those won't cause a problem at all. They've already been looking at it. Now, granted, they haven't looked at it much, but they did look at it. So in many areas, we don't need to reinvent the wheel and act like we're doing something new, but look at what others have done and build on that work, and we'll get to the answers much quicker. Let's look at from the key findings for public health practitioners and medical providers. Technology may enable us to gain the scalability of our interventions or treatments that right now isn't possible. I mean, public health has 100 models that work. You know, Hearst actually used to run this program called Models That Work. You know, you could find a new model. And many models work in the small studies that we do. None of them work, or not when you scale them up to the national level, or many of them can't be scaled to that level. So what good are they? And it's because, in part, sometimes they're very human intensive, and to do them you need armies of people, and it's just too expensive to do. Well, technology may enable us to scale our interventions in a way that's simply not possible now. We need to think about that. And that relates to cost effectiveness. You know, you don't have to pay benefits to technology, and things like that. They don't quit the job for divorces or, you know, other things. they enable, as I alluded to earlier, allow us to address what are now currently insurmountable challenges. The one I suggested was the hard to reach. You know, imagine public health practitioners and disparities researchers talking about, we no longer have a hard to reach population because we know how to reach them all. And let me just tell you, this is not stuff that's 50 years down the road, because largely the infrastructure that you need to do this kind of stuff, which is the backbone of the internet, is already in place. It's already in place for everybody, even the poorest of the poor. How can I say that? Why? Because we basically no longer have aerial TV. What does that have to do with anything? That means cable TV goes everywhere. A whole bunch of poor people got cable TV. And the poorest of the poor have 3 televisions in their house. So right now, the internet runs on those same cable lines. They're just not using it for that. You know, and right now TV is a passive medium, but it's changing before your eyes. You heard of Google TV, Apple TV, Hulu. All these things are changing it into an interactive format that you can do things through it. That's the kind of thinking we need in public health and medicine, that how can we have interactive relationships with our patients wherever they are. Now you can have TV, real live TV on your tablets that you carry around, Comcast Xfinity. That means that we can deliver interventions in real time on tablet PCs to anybody anywhere through Comcast Xfinity, if we were thinking like that. And that's exactly how we have to think for the future, because the infrastructure is already there. It's just a matter of us building the interventions, understanding what's going on, and using it in that way. It's not about the technology, though. I hear so many people all the time, oh, mHealth, we got a mobile phone, we got a TV, let's go do it. I think it's entirely the wrong way to go about it. What is the problem that needs to be fixed? Start at the basis. What's the problem? What's the health problem, the social problem, whatever? And then, is there a role for technology? Technology is an enabler of many things. It is not the solution unto itself. There's an adjunct effect. I'm not talking about simply replacing all doctors and nurses or public health practitioners or hospitals, because we can go into all of your homes. The studies that are coming out, our study looking at a systematic review funded by AHRQ looking at the effect of consumer health informatics, showed that in those studies where you compared the device or the consumer health informatics versus a provider or a public health intervention without technology intervention to a control, and then both together, showed that in many of the studies, the both together, that is the provider or health practitioner with the technology, had better outcomes than what was achieved by either by themselves. So it's about enabling us to do what we do now even better. Even better. Some cases it's doing things we can't do now. In some cases it's reaching some we can't reach now. But it's also about helping us do what we do better, not simply or at all am I advocating replacing the human touch. And as Adel brought out earlier, in many populations the human touch is essential to get people started down this road and to keep them going. So there are still many opportunities for the human touch in there. But we must, again, it's not just about getting people to use it. We've got to use it to change the way we do things. Because if we continue to do things, whether we're talking about public health or medicine, the same way, but bring technology in, we'll get the same results, only faster. And because everything will be electronic. And there's no silver bullet. One size does not fit all. We need to understand more about people and their differences and their challenges to be able to build the tools to fit different, customize and target the tools. In terms of developers and vendors, some of which are providers, but most of which are engineers, social entrepreneurs, unfortunately, which I think is a problem because they see it, they get it, they know that there's big dollars in this and this is why they're doing it. We need to be leading it because we see there's big opportunity to improve health. But at any rate, as I alluded to before, we need to lead or else we're gonna spend the rest of our lives playing catch up. And I make the analogy to the whole complementary and alternative medicine movement in this country. I remember years ago when that started coming into this country, you know, medicine, and to some extent public health, although public health was much more of an earlier adopter compared to medicine, but they say, oh, be careful, stay away from those weeds and seeds, they're just going to kill you, you're going to self-treat, you're going to die. And then it became an $85 billion industry in this country. And guess who, what academic centers have a CAM center, as they lovingly call it? Johns Hopkins and every other major academic center, because it's too big to ignore. And that's what people do. And they're going there. It's the identical problem here. People are going there. The country is going there. Are we going to lead or are we going to be paying catch up? Build on the existing foundation of the evidence base. There is a large evidence base, not only in the medical literature, but in the engineering literature and in others. Be problem-focused, outcome-oriented, and user population-driven, not just the typical science for the sake of science-driven and knowledge for the sake of knowledge. That's good. I do that too. But, you know, we don't have people are dying by us not fixing these problems, and we've had very little improvement. We need to become more problem-focused, outcome-oriented, and user population-driven. Don't reinvent the wheel, as I say. Look at other fields. And finally, policymakers. I think, you know, it's clear that there is no, in the same way there's no perfect pill, there's no perfect public health intervention, one single thing that'll work for everybody, there is no one single policy that's going to work to fix all of the healthcare disparities. What's better is to try to embrace policies or to put in place policies that embrace a patient, a consumer, or population orientation, not only a provider or a healthcare practitioner orientation. Again, if we fix the healthcare system or the health system only, that won't be enough to get us where we think we want to go. Seek policies that incentivize change. Change is difficult for all of us. We all become vested in the ways that we're doing things because we're doing it that way, whether it's good or not so good. But if you give I think the federal government has shown that when you incentivize change, amazing things can happen. I think the whole EMR world is a good part of that, meaningful use, and on and on and on. Build on foundational policy work and foster tipping points, not perfect policies. I think the idea here is, as Malcolm Gladwell talks about in his book, The Tipping Point, trying to get everybody involved in the process, no matter where they are, wherever you are, being focused on what you can do or your company or your organization or your research or whatever to help us understand the problem or fix the problem of disparity, rather than trying to find the few experts, the few people, the few interventions, the few policies that we believe will fix the whole thing, because they don't exist at all anyway. So, in the future, when we're doing all this stuff, what will it look like? Interventions, public health interventions, medical interventions can be delivered by a variety of formats, in person, over the web, game consoles, TV, cell phones, PDAs, when people need it, on demand, anytime, wherever they are, whether at home, whether in a hospital, whether they're homeless under the bridge, they can get them whenever they need them. The efficacy of traditional interventions is enhanced by technological adjuncts to treatment or care. As I said, interventions can be delivered anywhere and at any time. Disparities risks at the population level or at the individual level can be identified and addressed before they even become disparities at the population level. People don't delay seeking care because they're getting it all the time in many different ways. Over time, there exists real potential to make significant impact towards the goal of reducing and eliminating disparities in health and healthcare access, utilization, and outcomes. Thank you.